You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 8th of January 2013 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Moncler. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One here in London with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Turkey, Brazil and Sweden become the latest geopolitical pals as they form a new peace-building alliance.
I think we'll see if there's anything that we can do particularly on the Middle East. From Turkey, its position, geographic and historical, we are one of the countries inside the European Union that has been very active on these issues.
We'll be hearing more from Sweden's Foreign Minister Carl Bildt a little later on in the programme. Also ahead, Lebanon declares it's firmly open for business despite the turmoil in neighbouring Syria wreaking havoc with the country's tourism industry. And as South Sudan asks for old records in order to work out where its borders lie, we ask, when do old maps help solve new crises? All that, plus we play you some great music too, and we'll ask the burning question, is television dead? That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But before all that, let's catch up on the headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
Activists for women's rights staged an anti-rape protest for the 12th day today outside the residence of the Nepali Prime Minister Baburam Bhattari in the capital Kathmandu. Rita Thapa, who works for Sathi, which is concerned with women's issues, told reporters she was hoping for a long-term solution.
Not as a short-term goal, but as a long-term solution where the Nepali state can be more accountable to its people and the criminalization of politics and impunity, heightened impunity, can be brought to an end.
An advance party of Dutch and German troops has now arrived in Turkey to prepare for the arrival of Patriot missiles to protect the country from possible air attacks from Syria. Some 30 Dutch and 20 German soldiers boarded the transport plane at the Eindhoven Air Base in Holland, with the main body of European soldiers set to arrive 2 weeks later on the 21st of January. Yaakov Peri, a former head of the Israeli Internal Intelligence Agency who's standing in the general election on the 22nd of January, has said today that Israel faces the prospect of a new Palestinian uprising because of despair over stalled peace talks. His comments come as the far-right Bayit Yehundi party, headed by Naftali Bennett, increased its support in the latest opinion polls. This is worrying Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who months ago looked like he had an unassailable lead. In a speech in Jerusalem today, Bennett, himself a former settler, described his objection to a Palestinian state.
Well, regarding the Palestinian state, obviously I'm against it, and I realize that this goes against the common wisdom, but common wisdom was wrong so many times in history that it's not even worth quoting the so many examples that everyone was wrong.
Here in the British Isles, the Irish Prime Minister Enda Kenny has today called for an end to the violence which has been causing disruption in Belfast, the capital of neighbouring Northern Ireland.
And I do hope that the attention that's now being paid to it by the political process will bring about a situation where this can be calmed down and ended, because it is destroying the economics of a city that has made great efforts to restore itself and to restore its economic viability over the last number of years. I hope that it can be calmed down and ended in a very short time, in a way that will allow people to get on with their business.
The violence stemmed from protests over the removal of the British flag over Belfast City Hall. It has been among the province's worst since a 1998 peace accord ended 30 years of conflict. And finally, loved and hated in equal measure, London's underground rail network, known as the Tube, is 150 years old. Tomorrow, on the 9th of January 1863, the London Underground opened the world's first underground railway in central London. The former London mayor, Ken Livingstone, said today that without the Tube, London would never have grown into such an important city.
Without the Tube, London could not have grown to the size it did. 200 years ago, there were only about a million people in London, and you went to 8 million, but you had to have a really high intense underground railway to be able to do that. That's why all the world's cities like Beijing, Shanghai, Delhi are all now putting in tube systems.
And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Jonathan, thank you very much indeed. The time is 5 minutes past the hour. I'm Emma Nelson. You're tuned in to Midori House on Monocle 24. Ladies and gentlemen, meet Sweden, Brazil and Turkey, the newest allies on the geopolitical map. At a meeting in Izmir, the three nations created a new body called the Trilateral Solidarity for Building Peace. The organisation will build upon the country's shared perspectives on international policy, with particular focus on Iran's nuclear issue and the crisis in Syria. So where exactly will the new Troika seek to exert its influence, and how effective do they become acting as one? Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloom spoke to Sweden's foreign minister and the former prime minister Carl Bildt shortly before we came on air.
Now, I must admit, when we first suggested that Sweden, Brazil and Turkey should form their own diplomatic group, it was slightly tongue-in-cheek. However, you've now just finished your second trilateral meeting. What is it about the three countries that you think makes it easy for you to work together?
Well, I mean, it's true. When you came up with the idea, it was more sort of a media idea, and we hadn't thought about it ourselves. But, I mean, we have, if I see it from the Swedish side, we have excellent and good relationship with Turkey, excellent and good relationship with Brazil. And then we found it a rather good idea just to sit together, the three of us. And once having done it, we find that we have our different perspectives and backgrounds, needless to say. We have different geographies and different histories, but quite a lot in common. And we find it extremely valuable to exchange information, assessments and share positions.
The second meeting you've just finished off in Izmir, what were the main topics that you were discussing there?
Well, the pretext to start with that was that Turkey had its annual gathering of all of its ambassadors from all over the world. And that meant that both Mr. Patriota and myself, Mr. Davutoglu, were speaking to the Turkish ambassadors. Then we had both bilateral and trilateral meetings, and they focused quite a lot on the situation in the Middle East. We discussed, or to be precise, we more listened to the situation in Latin America as well, covered and exchanged views on the situation in the wider European area as well. So it was quite a lot of different items on the agenda.
And is there anything in particular that you're looking at that you think that the three of you together can really take a lead on?
I think we'll see if there's anything that we can do particularly on the Middle East. From Turkey, its position, geographic and historical, we are one of the countries inside the European Union that has been very active on these issues. And of course, Latin America and Brazil, they have special contacts in the wider parts of the world. And it might be that there is something that we can do there in order to try to smooth things out in that very problematic area of the world.
A third meeting is planned in Brazil in June. Do you have any thoughts yet on what sort of issues you'll be looking at there?
I think that's too early. I mean, we'll have meetings on other levels before that. We'll have our respective sort of directors of Middle East meeting well before that to discuss that particular issue. And then we haven't yet come to planning the details of the meeting that we're planning in the summer in Rio, but I'm quite certain there will be plenty to discuss. I unfortunately foresee that the global issues will not have been sorted out by then.
No, indeed. While we have you on, if you don't mind, let me ask you quickly about the situation in Syria, which obviously you've been discussing in recent days. After President Assad's speech over the weekend, are you in any way hopeful that there is still a diplomatic solution, or do you think the time for that has now passed?
I think there has to be at some point in time, but if we were to judge by the speech of President Assad, it looks very, very difficult at the moment. I mean, he was evidently trying to shore up the support that he might have still and see how far that goes. And that, of course, remains to be seen. And he was slamming a couple of doors in the face of the opposition as well, not that they were particularly keen to talk to him anyhow. But at some point in time, one has to realize that if there's not a sort of political diplomatic transition, that we'd be in all-out war. And that could have some devastating consequences. You've seen Lakhdar Brahimi say that he sees a risk for Somalia development in the Levant. That might be to carry it quite far, but it can't be excluded. And of course, there's a substantial difference between Somalia and the Horn of Africa and the corresponding development in the heart of the Middle East.
I mean, you say there's a danger it spirals out into an all-out war. I mean, what actually can still be done to prevent that? Because it seems like we've discussed, you know, many different diplomatic options over the previous year or so, and yet the situation is still getting worse.
The situation is still getting worse. And what has made it extremely difficult is, of course, the fact that we've had this split in the Security Council. If we were to bring the Security Council together, I'm not quite certain it would sort everything out automatically. As a matter of fact, it wouldn't. But it would create new openings and new possibilities for diplomacy to work. As long as the Security Council is as split as it is, I think it is exceedingly difficult. And that, of course, reflects the fact that the parties themselves on the ground are not particularly willing to talk to each other. But at some point in time, I would hope that looking at the stark facts of what we are facing, that there would be a willingness to talk and engineer a diplomatic solution and transition.
So just finally on that point, is your best hope somehow trying to persuade Russia initially and maybe even China that they need to compromise somewhat on their position on President Assad's future?
Well, I mean, everyone will have to compromise somewhat in order to carry this forward. Either you have a strategy where you go for the all-out victory by the one or the other side. That might be possible, but it looks like that's going to take quite some time. And I'm not quite certain what kind of country that would be left behind when you arrive at that particular stage. Or you're trying to engineer some sort of compromise, and a compromise by the very nature of the thing will have to require an element of accommodation from both sides.
Sweden's Foreign Minister and former Prime Minister Carl Bildt talking to our foreign editor Steve Bloomfield there. You're listening to Midori House. Coming up, despite the conflict across the border undermining its stability, we'll find out how Lebanon's latest tourism drive could bolster the economy. Stay with us. And as we've just mentioned, Lebanon's tourism industry has taken a beating of late. The conflict in neighbouring Syria has not only spilled over the borders, but has succeeded in driving visitors away. As a result, the country's tourism chiefs have slashed prices and told politicians to add a little more of a positive spin to their rhetoric. Carol Corm, Beirut correspondent for Monocle, joins us now. I'm delighted to say in the studio today here in London. Welcome, Carol.
Hi.
Just explain to us how dependent Lebanon is on tourism.
Lebanon is hugely dependent on tourism, on its service sector. I mean, we don't have any industry. The whole economy is an economy of entertainment, basically. So tourism is very, very important for us. It's, I think, a quarter of the GDP. And unfortunately, with what's happening in Syria, not as many people want to come to Lebanon, obviously.
Where is Lebanon's core customer base in terms of tourists?
I mean, our base is the Gulf Arabs who spend huge amounts of money in Lebanon. And also a big portion is the expat Lebanese who will come no matter what. And I think this is what the government needs to encourage, is that these Lebanese who have family in Lebanon, they will come even if there's a conflict in Syria.
Now, one of the firms involved in this drive, Middle East Airlines, denies that last month two of its planes were targeted by surface-to-air missiles while they were flying in Syrian airspace. It's clearly a sign that the Syrian conflict is exerting extremely extreme pressure on the tourism industry. How have you seen the tourism industry die away or change in the last few months?
Well, it's been really tough. I mean, talking to restaurant owners or hotel people, it's been very difficult. A lot of people are saying after a bomb or after a big event, you know, that there's no one showing up in the restaurants. But despite all that, I'd like to say that, and this is maybe a nature of the Lebanese, I mean, people still go out. Christmas was still a fairly good season. I mean, people live for the day in Lebanon. So even if there's instability, that's a kind of way of life. So there's a boutique hotel that opened a few months ago. There are still restaurants opening, even if some others are closing. So the story is always a little bit more complicated in Lebanon.
Nonetheless, we've seen clashes in Tripoli as the fighting has spilled over from the Syrian border. How lasting can the economic damage be on the long, you know, on the day-to-day workings of the tourism industry?
Well, the thing with Lebanon is, even during the civil war, you had people partying in one area and people getting shelter, looking for shelter in another city, and that's Lebanon for you. So Tripoli might be unstable, but things in Beirut will still be fine. And I think in that respect, Israel is similar. Some people in Tel Aviv might be living in this bubble and having a good time, eating organic food, going out. And then in another part of the country, it's a very different story.
The fact is, the government has now stepped in, and it is also telling politicians to perhaps
change their mood.
Change their mood. What was the mood like, and what needs to be said?
I mean, the situation's pretty catastrophic. Right now, there's a huge storm in Lebanon. The economic situation is terrible. The Gulf Arabs are not coming because they're afraid of kidnappings, of what's happening in Syria, etc. So, I mean, the tourism minister is doing what he can. And whether people are looking up to him, I don't think so. But it's a good effort, and I think it's an effort that might be heard by expat Lebanese who'll say, you know what, there's 50% off if I go to Beirut this month, why not?
There are reports, however, that although the tourists from, as you say, the Gulf states, which used to come in their droves, they're not coming to spend their money. However, the cafes are still full, the hotels are still full, the streets are still full, but they're full of Syrians. What's that like?
Well, there's a lot of expat Syrians now, refugees that are fleeing the conflict. I mean, Damascus is just 2 hours away by car from Lebanon. So you have a lot of middle-class Syrians who have moved to in rental apartments. They kind of saved the day for a bit of the hotel industry last summer because they were the ones who filled all the hotel rooms. But, I mean, we also have lots of refugees, a huge amount for relative to Lebanon's population, and that's more difficult to manage.
I was going to say, how does that change the dynamic of a country when you have this great influx of refugees who are, A, homeless, and so there'll be a depressed element to it, but, B, their spending power is greatly reduced?
Yeah, it's very difficult. It's very difficult. And right now in Lebanon, you see, big shows of wealth. You see Syrian, you know, beautiful cars with Syrian plates. And then you also have these refugees who don't even have blankets and who are living in very dire situations.
So if we were to be looking to go on holiday in Lebanon in the next few weeks and months, how good a bargain can we find now?
You would find a good bargain. You'd still find a very strong joie de vivre, because that's a Lebanese despite anything. There's still cool restaurants, there's still cool clubs. New Year's was fun. I mean, you don't see the whole picture when you go as a tourist. And it's a fun place. It's only 4 hours away. And despite the storm this week, the weather is much better than in Europe. So I still advise people to come visit.
Carol Kuhn, Monocle's Beirut correspondent. Many thanks, as ever, for coming on the show today. You're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. We'll be back in a moment to ask how old British colonial maps may be being used to settle boundary disputes in South Sudan.
During snowy December, Midori House is brought to you by Montclair. And from December the 27th to January the 2nd, we'll be heading off piste to broadcast the briefing in Midori House live from St Moritz. Montclair, keeping the slopes stylish and warm since 1952.
The bumper December-January issue of Monocle takes a look over the horizon at 2013 and beyond, introducing you to the people you need to work with, giving you an insight into which nations are on the rise, spotlighting the best in retail, and letting you eavesdrop on conversations with the leaders in everything from foreign policy to trim typography. And there's much, much more.
This month in the culture section, we tour Asia in search of the continent's best cinemas, from Bangkok's Art Deco Scala Theatre to the Singapore cinema that feels more like a first-class plane cabin. We knock on the door of the Munich retirement home set up for the city's aging journalists, artists, actors and singers at one of the city's more enviable addresses.
In the design section, we canvass the opinions of four giants from the world of graphic design. We also drop in on the UN headquarters in New York to see how the renovation of the council chamber is coming along. And we visit a perfect city bolt hole in Helsinki.
The December-January issue also includes our Turkey travel survey and is on sale now. Make sure you have all your holiday reading sorted, and remember, you can buy gift subscriptions at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
It's just coming up to 20 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Now, it is commonly held that in order for a nation state to exist, it must enjoy geographical certainty. In other words, for a country to be a country, it must have borders, which perhaps explains just how important South Sudan's request to the British government for a series of old colonial maps could be. These maps show the boundaries between South Sudan and Sudan, and it's hoped they could offer some resolution to the border conflicts that have troubled the nation since South Sudan established itself as an independent state in 2011. Well, Frank Jacobs, cartography enthusiast and author of the blog Strange Maps, joins us in the studio to tell us more. Welcome, Frank, to Midori House. Just explain to us what exactly South Sudan has asked the British government for.
Well, they've asked the government of the UK for maps of the pre-independent Sudan, which shows the borders as they were drawn up by the British, the provincial borders, which have now become international borders.
So how important in Africa, let's say, are colonial maps in terms of establishing borders?
Well, they're absolutely vital because most African borders are still colonial borders or were drawn up by the colonial powers and have not been changed afterwards by the independent nations. And there's a case even recently of a dispute between Nigeria and Cameroon about an oil-rich peninsula, which was decided by looking at the borders drawn up between Germany and Britain in the early 20th century.
So why were these borders placed where they were? You mentioned there a question of resources. Is it often a question of resource nationalism, or is it a tribal issue, or is it the Germans and the French tussling over who's going to have control over what sort of urban area?
Well, I think having colonial borders is, in a sense, a wonderful opportunity for the nations in Africa at the moment, because they are third-party borders. They were drawn up long before by people who are no longer involved. So to be able to go back to these borders, which are obviously very arbitrary, but at least they were not drawn up by either party, and say, okay, let's go back to the drawing board and see what was there and find these borders and implement them, is a way of resolving a conflict.
To what degree does it resolve a conflict? Does it have any... It is obviously not legally binding, but how effective is the use of an old map to resolve a modern argument?
Well, that depends on how accurate the map is, because we have the issue now in Sudan where people are on either side are disputing where the actual border is, because the maps apparently that they have are not accurate enough. So if you have a very accurate colonial map, and if both parties agree to be arbitrated by that map, then you have a solution.
Do you ever get the situation where... You almost have a game of top trumps, and one person saying, well, I have this map and this says this, and the opposite party says, well, I have this map and it says this, and then you tussle over who has ultimate authority. What happens in that situation?
Well, you go to arbitration. You go to the United Nations, which has special courts and special commissions that deal with this sort of thing. Obviously, and unfortunately, that can drag on and it can last decades even. And there are many, many conflicts right now which have lasted for many decades and probably will for many decades more.
So without borders, how can the likes of South Sudan enjoy self-determination, and will there just be constant conflict? Can a country and its neighbour actually design a new map, a new border?
Well, conventionally, countries want a single and very clear border, but maybe we could go to a situation where we can actually live with a grey zone. There is a grey zone now between Sudan and South Sudan, a 14-mile-wide demilitarized zone, which is not being implemented at all. But why not... Why couldn't both countries not find a way to live with the grey zone and perhaps share the resources that are in that zone instead of fighting over them?
And finally, when we're talking about something like, we were talking about this a few days ago, about the issue of the Senkaku Islands, mm-hmm. and neither party is agreeing to arbitration. Can a map ever show the way forward? Because I'm sure that the Japanese will have one map that says it's theirs, and the Chinese will say, actually, that's been ours all the time.
Well, it's a game not a game of chicken, but who calls the chicken what? For example, there's a conflict between Malawi and Tanzania about about the resources that might be hidden beneath the lake. But the Malawians call the lake Lake Malawi, and the Tanzanians call it Lake Nyasa. So it's even the naming itself is disputed.
Frank Jacobs, map expert, many thanks indeed for coming into Midori House. The time is just approaching 25 minutes past the hour. The news is just around the corner, taking us there. This is Julia by The Very Best. From their album, The Warm Heart of Africa, that was The Very Best from Malawi, and that track was called Julia. The time is 29 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. In the final half hour of today's programme, we'll delve into a report that suggests good design is integral to good education, and continuing that vein, we'll sit down with the Monocle design editor Hugo MacDonald to examine 2013's architectural highlights. All that, plus lots more coming up in just a moment, but before that, let's get the latest world news headlines from Jonathan.
Thank you very much, Emma. Activists for women's rights staged an anti-rape protest for the 12th day today outside the residence of the Nepali Prime Minister Babaram Bhattari in the capital Kathmandu. An advance party of Dutch and German troops has now arrived in Turkey to prepare for the arrival of Patriot missiles to protect the country from possible air attacks from Syria. The main body of European soldiers will arrive 2 weeks later on the 21st of January. Yaakov Peri, a former head of the Israeli Internal Intelligence Agency, who's standing in the general election on the 22nd of January, has said today that Israel faces the prospect of a new Palestinian uprising because of despair over stalled peace talks. His comments come as a far-right party increased its support in the latest opinion polls there. The Irish Prime Minister Enda Kenny has today called for an end to violence which has been causing disruption in Belfast in Northern Ireland. The violence stems from protests over the removal of the British flag over Belfast City Hall. It's been among the province's worst since the 1998 peace accord ended 30 years of conflict. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Jonathan, thank you very much indeed. Jonathan will be back in a little under 30 minutes to bring us a full roundup of today's news. Now, you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24, coming to you live from London. Now, what happens within the four walls of a classroom is, of course, critical in the formation of an individual. But a new report has indicated that the shape and structure of a pupil's learning environment can have a significant impact on his or her development. To tell us more, I'm delighted to say we're joined by the lead author of the study, a professor from Salford's School of the Built Environment, Peter Barrett. He joins us on the line now. Peter, thank you very much indeed for joining us here on Monocle 24. Just to explain to us the premise of this research that you've carried out.
Okay, there's... good evening, Emma, by the way. There's lots of information about what seems to be good about built environment spaces and human beings, but it tends to focus on specific aspects and not really take a holistic view of the whole effect of a space on a person. And so we decided to study school children, particularly primary school children, because they spend all their time pretty much in one room, and there are very clear measures of their academic progress.
I'm sure it is no surprise that to say if a child spends all day in a damp, cold porter cabin, then his or her education will not be as fruitful, perhaps, if you place him or her in a clean, well-lit space in which he or she can thrive. How does this report stand out from what many would understand as a common held thought?
Okay. Some of those commonly held thoughts, of course, are quite sensible, and good lighting is important, and that is one of the things that came through. But some more subtle things became apparent as well, and I suppose the thing which we think is different about our study is that we actually have managed to correlate these with the academic progress of the children. But things like the colour of the classroom, things like the flexibility of the classroom, the corridors associated with classrooms and their characteristics, they all came through. And in fact, there was a theme about some of these issues where actually the classrooms seemed to be overstimulating for young children in particular to study. So this affected issues like colour and the visual complexity of the spaces being provided. So yes, the sort of things you mentioned are important, I'm sure, but there were other things coming through just as strongly that weren't so obvious.
What wasn't so obvious, and when you mentioned things like areas, features such as colour, which help a child thrive, what does make a child do well?
Okay, so the literature would tell you that young children like brighter colours and older children like cooler colours, in broad terms. And we factored that in as an expectation in our propositions, and actually it came out negatively correlated. That means that in relation to learning, what the young children like, the brighter colours, actually don't produce better learning. The cooler colours actually produce better learning. So there's a functional effect which is different from an aesthetic choice.
And when it comes to better results, you mentioned that you can correlate your results to academic success. How much better did the pupils in the better environment do?
Okay, so we we could only scale that within the sample we had. It was 34 classrooms in Blackpool across seven schools, but it affected 751 pupils. And if you took what was the least effective classroom and compared it with the most effective classroom, it had something like the average improvement of a child over the year as the difference between them in terms of the impact of the built environment. So it's a significant effect, and it scaled at something like 25% of all the impacts affecting a child's progress, many of which, of course, are personal to the individual children.
And when you mention the individual child doing well, in terms of a long-term impact on his or her education, what are we looking at?
Well, we can't really assess that. What we looked at was their progress in the previous year in that space. Whether that's, of course, going to have a cumulative effect, we would hope so. But that's really beyond the scope of the study.
Very recently, there was quite a lot of coverage in the British newspapers, at least, by the cost-cutting measures introduced by the coalition government in the United Kingdom. And the aspects that hit the headlines were the removal of translucent roofs that allow light through, and more importantly, the banning of curves in the design of schools. Is it really scandalous to ban a curve from school, or is that just a sensible approach given the fact that we are in straitened economic circumstances?
So I have a personal view that that's really tinkering at a level of design that probably you shouldn't. But actually, the schools we looked at were all pretty traditional schools, and they didn't really have curves. And so it's not something that we came across as being massively important. We did talk to the Education Funding Agency about our results, and they were generally supportive. But their view really is that it's up to the sector to actually find out about this sort of thing and use it. They're not going to make rules about it or prescribe things around it. But what we would say is that a lot of the things we're talking about aren't expensive, don't demand big schools. They're actually things that the teachers can do themselves to a fair extent, not all of them, but some of them. And so they're not sort of inherently costly, which I would have thought would be of interest at this stage.
Have you found any place in particular, any country in particular, that does it well?
We've only looked globally through the literature. The OECD, for instance, has catalogues of what they think are exemplary schools, and I'm sure some of them are very good in architectural terms, but we haven't studied them. What we actually think is that some of the factors aren't to do with huge issues of architectural merit. They're to do with quite practical, down-to-earth things. I'll give you one example. We saw quite a lot of schools with quite big windows that had a lot of furniture in front of them, filing cabinets, drawers, and that sort of stuff, so hardly any light was coming through. And that's not rocket science. It's just something that can quite easily be remedied. And so we weren't really into assessing the architectural merit of these classrooms. We were looking at them through the eyes of the pupils and the effect it was having on them. In terms of just the naturalness of the environment, the level of stimulation being right, and their opportunity to individualise their use of the space.
Who would have thought it could have been as simple as moving a filing cabinet? Professor Peter Barrett from the University of Salford, many thanks for coming on the programme. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with more on the design theme. Monocle's very own design seer, Hugo MacDonald, will be outlining his architectural prophecies for the year ahead.
The bumper December-January issue of Monocle takes a look over the horizon at 2013 and beyond, introducing you to the people you need to work with, giving you an insight into which nations are on the rise, spotlighting the best in retail, and letting you eavesdrop on conversations with the leaders in everything from foreign policy to trim typography. And there's much, much more.
In the affairs section, I head to New York City to meet the foreign ministers of Sweden, Brazil and Turkey as they launch their own diplomatic group. And we also go to Basra to see how investment in the port could make that city a regional economic power.
In the business pages, we look north to explore the towns that are set to benefit most from an Arctic resource boom. We also meet the Spanish entrepreneurs who are cooking, inventing and manufacturing Madrid out of economic trouble, and find out why savvy customers still care where their favourite products are made.
The December-January issue also includes our Turkey travel survey and is on sale now. Make sure you have all your holiday reading sorted, and remember, you can buy gift subscriptions at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
The Entrepreneurs is about the movers and shakers, the lone rangers, the innovators, the modern mercantile mavericks, and the venerable merchandisers. It's Monocle 24's weekly business show. Every week, we seek out the startups, the brands on the make, and the leaders of global business empires doing things differently.
Assume you don't know the answer. If you assume that, you have to start creating options for yourself.
From master cobblers to asset managers, from impresarios in the luxury yacht sector to tech startups shaking up Silicon Valley. Tune in on Wednesdays at 1900 hours London time or download the show on Monocle 24's website.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
Welcome back to Midori House. Now, we've just heard from Professor Peter Barrett, who's the author of a report extolling the virtuous correlation between good design in schools and a good education for a child. Now, we turn to someone who himself unashamedly champions the design cause. Of course, our design editor, Hugo MacDonald. Welcome, Hugo.
Thank you very much, Emma.
You're here to point us in the direction of some of the great design or the architectural highlights that 2013 will have to offer us. You wanted to start off with a really lovely idea in Italy.
Indeed, I did. To give my read on 2013, I thought rather than talking about the numerous trade fairs that I'm going to be attending with zillions more chairs, I thought it would be more interesting to look at the buildings that I'm very excited about seeing. And we do start in Milan, which is a very grey city, particularly for given how beautiful cities like Venice, Florence, Rome particularly. Milan is concrete, but Stefano Boeri, who is a fantastic architect and urban planner there, has been busy crafting these amazing apartment towers called the Bosco Verticali, which we'll complete in the summer. And what they are, Bosco Verticali means vertical forests, and these two gigantic apartment blocks have promontories sticking out in various sort of ways from each story, on which are planted trees, bushes, shrubs, flowers. So there's a little picture in front of you.
It's delightful. They are two, as you say, beautiful green vertical towers, which will stand out in a very gorgeous way in the Milan city skyline. It's a clever way of addressing the fact that Milan is a very polluted place, isn't it?
Exactly. And his idea behind this is to create these two lungs in the heart of the concrete city, with over 900 trees planted vertically up them. And I mean, they look like something that you would find maybe in some sort of Inca shrine in the heart of a jungle, rather than the heart of the concrete jungle that is Milan.
And what area is this going in, and who is supposed to be living in these lovely towers?
They are privately owned, and they are right in the heart of Milan. The name escapes me, the district itself, but it's Porta Nuova, which is right there in the middle. And over the last few years, I've seen them sort of go up. And given the promontories where everything is going to be planted, sort of jut out at various sort of random intersections throughout the building, they're beautiful enough as it is in concrete. But I can't wait to see the finished result.
I just have a horrible feeling that someone's going to wake up one morning and do some really judicious pruning and then hack a tree out, sick of the fact that the view has been interrupted by their green view. It is a lovely idea. One wonders how cost-effective it is.
Indeed. I mean, there's obviously many, many drawbacks, but as a visual architectural statement, and also as a statement to sort of cleaning the city or being aware of trying to inject a bit of green into a very grey, polluted city, I think a round of applause to Mr. Boeri.
One wonders what's going to happen in 10 years' time when someone realises that there's a root growing through their living room. But we wish them absolutely the best of luck. It is a very beautiful idea. Another beautiful idea is happening in Christchurch in New Zealand, isn't it?
Indeed.
An area that was decimated by an earthquake and has been the scene of quite a lot of political discord in terms of what should replace the cathedral, which was knocked down to the dismay of many hundreds of people.
Absolutely. Well, enter Shigeru Ban, the Japanese architect, who is known for working with extraordinary materials in extraordinary ways. And he has come up with the idea of this temporary cathedral made of cardboard. This will be completing in February, and it's built on a series of shipping containers which form the same layout as the original cathedral that's been knocked down. And on top of it, it has these beautiful cardboard poles and a series of various coloured stained glass windows that are suspended there. Again, sort of fascinating idea. It's something that through various renderings and things, it's difficult to really see what the finished result will look like. But if anybody can work wonders with cardboard, it is Shigeru Ban.
How sustainable an idea is it?
Incredibly sustainable when you think that it's made from shipping containers that have been taken out of use and cardboard. The cardboard he uses doesn't obviously go to mulch in the rain. It has a little bit of plastic in it, which means that it's still biodegradable, but it's also very sturdy. And so thrilled are the residents of Christchurch at the idea of it, that it's already been mooted to be a little bit more permanent than I think it's only supposed to be around for maybe 3 years at the moment. But I think it has the trappings of an Eiffel Tower or something that might be around for a lot longer.
It looks absolutely lovely too. And one does hope that something that is supposed to be transitional will actually ease the development of a city that obviously had to reassess its entire identity once the earthquake struck it. Now, something that drew my eye, which you wanted to talk about as well, was the new Doha International Airport. Why is this such an important piece of architecture?
Well, important really because it's the first airport that has been built from scratch since the A380 Airbus has been in operation. And it's an airport on a gigantic scale that is built specifically to handle A380s. So it's going to turn sort of Doha into a complete transport hub, which is going to be very important, obviously, for local economy. But also it's actually a very beautiful, poetic airport, which too many airports that are built nowadays really don't have poetry written into their structures at all. From above, and the picture that I've given you is fairly difficult to make this out, it is actually in the shape of an aeroplane. And HOK, who's a gigantic global architecture practice, has really sort of flexed its creative as well as its logistical muscles with this.
Hugo McDonald, thank you very much indeed for telling us what we should be looking out for on our skylines in 2013. You're listening to Midori House.
This is Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
A Monocle 24 podcast, yeah.
Monocle 24, you're welcome.
This is Monocle 24.
Tämä on Monocle 24. Dobro pozdravat.
Monocle 24.
This is 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 Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
In a moment here on Midori House, we'll be asking, is television dead? But time for some music first. This is Lakeisha Benjamin with Jump and Shout.
Got no wheels in my
Three or four baby mamas healing around the block, up the hall, up in the heights. Can't you come in the room? Got his socks laying on the table, smell his own steak and stuff. Eating a cheese sandwich, like it's his house. I know all about that. Shoot, lucky I'm not jumping and shot right now. Yeah, I feel you though.
From last year's album, Retox, that was Lakeisha Benjamin with Jump and Shout. You're listening to Monocle 24.
From a breed of Italian sheep brought back from extinction to vintage recipes revitalising the dairy business in a remote part of Norway, Monocle Films brings you inspiring tales of mountain producers on a mission.
Mikhail's restaurants depend on locally sourced produce for its recipes, which have attracted a faithful following. It's proof, if ever proof were needed, that when restaurants work in collaboration with local food producers, it's possible to make a sustainable business out of organic farming and to create a distinct regional culinary identity.
Making it work in the mountains on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24, where the time is 8 minutes before the top of the hour. Now, this week on Monocle 24, we've been hearing from the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, where people are still apparently getting very excited about very big televisions with the smartest setups. But this glitzy veneer perhaps disguises a new truth. For the first time, the number of televisions in relation to the population is actually declining. So here's a big question. Could the age of the TV be over? And if not only the technology, but also the culture of watching television is changing, what could that mean for our viewing habits and for the way in which we consume media more generally? Well, to ask all these questions is the television historian and emeritus professor of communications at the University of Leeds here in the UK, Nicholas Proney. Nicholas, welcome as ever to Monocle 24. Just explain to us, before we start going into the ins and outs of the way that we watch programmes now, what do we mean by a television? Do we mean by a television set sitting in one's living room?
Well, that is exactly what is changing. For a very long time, you could almost call it an age. For a very long time, you had in the corner of your room something that was almost like an altar. A great solid set, a beautifully positioned, occupying that space there like some kind of a holy object. And you were expected to look at it communally with your family and with great reverence. Now, it is that kind of television, supposedly the highest time of your day and the highest form of your being, it is that kind of idea of television which is changing.
And it was a television that could, in fact, set people's daily agenda, that we would sit down and watch something at a certain time, which would then be discussed the next morning. We've been talking about the evolution of people's viewing habits for quite a long time now, but the fact that the ratio of televisions to people is declining, what does that now indicate?
Well, what it indicates is that that kind of television, that kind of thing which retailers sell as a television set is relatively declining. Why? Because people view what they want to view on some various alternative technologies, on their tablets, on their iPhones and so on. So therefore, it isn't a case that the total technology for receiving audiovisual images has declined. Far from it. But it is that particular kind of thing which we used to call television, with almost a capital T, that is what is declining. Because people no longer live like that, because they no longer look at that sort of sacred object in the corner in that kind of way. And above all, it is they who are in charge of their viewing time and not some distant organization, the BBC or other one, which decides what you should view at what particular time, before and after what. That's dead and gone. And with that, television, with that sort of capital T, you know, terribly important, royal commissions and all that, that is the kind of thing which is disappearing. But people certainly view, consume, if you prefer the word, a vast range of audiovisual material through a variety of technologies. Now, no longer that so-called television set.
What about the likes of very big televisions or offers of high definition and, you know, better ways of viewing one's programmes? Is that at all stemming this tide of new equipment which is making us change our habits?
Well, funnily enough, it's part of it. Because what you have is the convergence between the cinema and the television. So we used to talk about, you know, the small screen with all its particular characteristic limitations, blah, blah, and the big screen, the cinema. Now, that is what is now, has become blurred, and what people have now, what quite often is actually called home cinema. And you don't use that kind of very big, high-definition set which gives you the same sort of audiovisual experience which you get in the cinema, because these sets also come with, you know, excellent sound systems and so on. For the same kind of sort of day-to-day, small-scale, information-based or entertainment-based viewing, as you used to use the television. So now you view what that television set can provide for you, that experience, as a treat, you know, like as if you went to the cinema. And so therefore, a huge increase in watching cinema films on television, almost shouldn't say on television, watching cinema films in your home is one of the things which is replacing the traditional quote-unquote television.
Nicholas Pronet, Emeritus Professor of Communications, many thanks indeed for coming on today's programme. That's all we have time for today. My thanks to our producer, Alid John, our researcher, Hayley Joelle Ott, and our studio manager, Ben Jay. Up next after the news is this week's episode of Section D. We heard him talking about architecture just now. Today, Hugo MacDonald will be examining how the rest of the design world is approaching 2013. In 3 hours' time, that's at 2200 hours here in London, Andrew Muller and Louise Beale will be your hosts for the Monocle Daily, and Louise will be back in this seat to bring you Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for the time being, from me, Emma Nelson, thanks for listening and goodbye.